A podcast of the cinema.
Hello, husband.
Hello, husband.
How are you?
I'm good.
How's your day? How's it going today with you?
I
know we've been in the same 900 square feet nonstop since we both woke up, but I just would like to check in. How are you feeling?
I'm good. I'm finishing my second coffee, so you know all is right with the universe.
I'm baking a cake.
Yes.
Your name. Wait, I forgot. Hey, new people who are listening for the first time. Welcome to the Film Critic Show.
Hi.
Called the Linoleum Knife. Starring you. Your name is Alonzo Duralde.
And you're Dave White.
We're film critics. He's a more important one than I am.
Hardly.
Well, you're more decorated.
Well, okay, fine.
You're the man who's the editor of the reviews of The Wrap.
True.
And you're the man who's on What the Flick.
True.
You're the star. I'm the Mac in the back. Keeping your shirts together, making sure you look good, filling your head full of deep thoughts.
Look, you know what? I think the thing
about cinema.
Based on feedback I get from folks in the world, the thing that I do that most people seem to know exists is the occasional visit to Madeline Brand on KCRW, and I never do that without you, so.
That's true, I guess. People respond to that more than anything?
Usually, yeah. I mean, that's...
But you're out in the world in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And people in Los Angeles who know you enough to talk to you about yourself and your life.
That's the thing they bring up.
Well, they're also the people who would listen to NPR.
Well, right. But I'm just saying, more
which people... Which is what KCRW is.
Yes, but I think I get more traction out of that, you know, once a month, once every 6 weeks, however often that we're on, than all the other toiling
I would like
that I do.
To know, I've asked this maybe once before, but I would like to know if our joint appearances on Press Play with Madeline Brand on KCRW
ever lead people here?
Who heard us there and started listening to us here?
Good question. Because in listener mail,
we never know where people come from.
Well, in listener
unless
mail,
unless they just straight up tell us.
Yeah, I say people will say that they heard they watch What the Flick. You know,
I always hear that it's from What the Flick.
Yeah.
Everybody that I hear about comes to us from What the Flick.
Right. But I think those are people who want to hear a lot of film reviews, whereas people who don't and it just sneaks up on them are the ones listening to Madeline Brand because they had NPR on anyway. I don't know. Anyway.
The reason I'm making a cake, this is more important than anything
yes,
we've just discussed.
By all means.
But I would like to know, if you heard us on Madeline Brand, and that's how you came to us, and now you're a regular listening person. Tell us.
Yeah.
I want to know. I just want to know. I'm curious.
Or if you heard us on Overnight America.
I'm curious. I don't think I've heard anyone come to us from Overnight America.
But they're very nice about naming the show
all
the time. So, you know.
I like to think constantly.
That worked
but
for somebody.
That show is on at 1:30 in the morning.
Well, you can listen to a podcast whenever you want. So there's some night owl out there.
I know.
You
know. I know. No, we don't stay up until 1:30 in the morning to do that. This is the magic of pre-recording everything. But the...
You're making a cake.
Well, it's Pilar's birthday.
Yeah, well, yesterday, technically. Today, observed.
Whatever, observed.
Right.
It's not officially her birthday until she sits down at this table and gets a cake.
Fair enough.
Pilar is our niece.
The rest is prelude.
She lives here in Los Angeles. She's a go-getter.
She is.
A young, ambitious screenwriter.
She is off to Park City soon for Slam Dance, which is more than I can say for me.
Is she working for them?
Yeah, she's been their intern, and she's going to work the festival.
Oh, okay.
Whereas I am...
Do you get paid for being an intern?
No, but I mentioned to somebody...
how's she making money?
I mentioned to some industry person that she was interning at Slam Dance, and industry person was very impressed and said, ooh, those people get jobs.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I have to move the phone again because it's
buzzing.
Yes,
you do, because you learn nothing ever, and you keep making the same mistakes over and over again. So she's going to Park City. I am not this year, as it turns out. I couldn't nail down my usual lodgings, and so for the first time in several years, I'm not going to Sundance, and not that broken up about it, frankly.
I can feel your status in the world slipping already.
But wait,
and I'm concerned for you. I have none, so there's nowhere for me to slip to.
The weird thing about it, though, is in years past, they never showed us anything before Park City. It was all like, this was the great unveiling, and no pre-screenings, no advance, nothing. You saw it up there.
Right.
And this year, I'm getting offered a ton of screenings.
That's exciting
for more you. Than I can even go to. I'm having to get other writers at the Wrap to go cover all these screenings. So,
not me.
Yes, well. So that's kind of an interesting shift in the paradigm.
Although I do have two reviews to write for the Wrap this week.
Yes, you do.
Well, and as soon as the publicists send me the damn screeners,
I'll
get to looking at those movies.
They're on their way. We're told,
mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Last night was the LA Film Critics Dinner.
The Los Angeles Film Critics Association.
Yes.
Of which you are a member.
Correct.
I am not.
You doggedly refuse to become one.
I don't have disdain for the group, but I just don't like being in groups most of the time.
Fair enough.
I would be in this group. I mean, okay. I would be a LAFCA member provided, as I said to Todd Gilchrist last night.
Yes.
He's a member. He's a film critic, and he's a member of the group.
He's been on the show before.
I said to him, also, he is a friend of the show and has been a guest on this show, yes. I said to him, because he asked me again, why aren't you in this group? And I said, like, positive K. I got a man. Yes. I am... Mrs. Alonzo Duralde.
You get all the screeners you want and never have to attend any meetings.
I got to go to no meetings. I said, he goes, well, what if we've just ganged up and voted you in against your will? I said, first of all, good luck convincing the older members to know who I am at all. Okay. Secondly, I have a list of demands. Here they are. I get to decide who lives and who dies regarding all aspects of the awards dinner. Meaning, whoever gets up on the mic, I get to make the decision about who who's allowed to do that. Secondly, one couple equals one dues.
which would apply only to us.
That is correct. I'm such a cheapskate. I get irritated paying your dues every year.
Well,
yeah.
Nonetheless,
so I am not.
There are very few events that
I love being at the dinner with you.
Yes.
Even
though you kvetch about it a lot in advance.
Well, in advance only when I think that you guys aren't going to obey my wishes.
I see.
Again, I do not have disdain for the group. Just sort of in groups about... I have disdain for groups in general.
No, I get it. And I'll tell you...
I like LAFCA and I like everyone I know in LAFCA.
It's a fun group.
And you guys did obey me this year by giving the Best Supporting Actress Award to Lily Gladstone for Certain Women.
Yes.
And that is... that means you are a legitimate group in my estimation.
I'll tell you, this year, I may never have my way as much as I had this year. And I mean, right. not that it was my way, but just in terms of the votes coming out the way I wanted them, all of the runoffs coming out, you know, when it was down to two people, the one that I wanted to win won. I suggested the Life Achievement Award winner who we wound up picking. I suggested the special citation that we wound up giving. Like, I was golden this year. I don't know how that worked out. It will never happen again, but I definitely...
I was a little freaked out because since you were the man who suggested the Lifetime Achievement recipient,
uh-huh.
that meant we sat at her table.
Yes.
And I was a little freaked out. Sitting at a dinner table with Shirley MacLaine.
Mm-hmm.
But she, happily, she ignored us.
Yes, well, it was a big round table. Yep. I intentionally...
She talked to her director friend and yes. to her publicist people and studio somebodies. And yeah.
I always make it a point to...
so that was good.
It's one of those deals where it's...
She didn't hog the butter.
She did not. It's a ballroom with, you know, a stage, and then the tables are all pretty much in front of or, you know, to somewhat to the side of. And so I politely, as a member of the group, if I'm sitting at a table with an honoree, I always take the crappy chair that nobody wants.
Yes.
With the back to the stage.
Back to the stage. Spotlight in your face.
Yes. So I did that.
Should have brought my sunglasses yes. in there.
But yeah. Ms. MacLaine was lovely. And
she was. And she was really funny, too.
She was. I got to introduce Jack Black, who in turn presented her with the award.
He was really funny, too. Funny together.
They were. They had a very charming back and forth. You could tell they really liked each other a lot. Yeah. I mean, I walked out into the lobby with them to do the picture afterwards, and they were just like,
right.
You know, and he was like, what? You've got a movie Sunday? So do I. We hang out. You know, like, it was very sweet. They very much dug each other.
Your intro was very nice.
Oh, well, thank
my
you.
My favorite one. No. Not just because I'm married to you, but because you're the best. On the mic, you're known to be the freshest.
I have mad flow.
Yeah.
There were really funny intros this year, and really, they were all like short and to the point and very genuine. I liked what Tim Cogshell had to say about cinematographers and
yep.
about the Moonlight cinematographer yep. specifically.
Yep.
I loved that Joe Morgenstern had a little keyboard app on his iPhone, and he played like two phrases from the La La Land score
yes.
when he was giving that award. I unfortunately, since I was out doing the photo with Ms. MacLaine and Mr. Black, I missed the Lily Gladstone speech, which you said was really lovely.
Very emotional.
Yeah.
She talked about how before she got cast in Certain Women, she was thinking very seriously of giving up acting and just going to be a teacher.
Wow.
And while that would have been a lovely profession and she would have been a very good teacher if she had done that, I wouldn't have been able to watch her in Certain Women exactly. and then command that you people give her the Best Supporting Actress Award. So it all worked out for all of us.
There we go. Also, I thought on the verge of tears the whole time was Mahershala Ali. He seemed
moved. He was very emotional, too.
Yeah.
And he's great
mm-hmm.
and quite tall.
Very tall. I brushed past him at one point, and it was the kind of thing where like, I was coming back into the room, and he was heading out. I kind of touched him on the elbow, and he gave me the acknowledgement of, oh, hey, I saw you on... This is all nonverbal, but he gave me the kind of nod of like, oh, yeah, I just saw you on stage, and I gave him the nod of, oh, my God, you're Mahershala Ali.
Yeah.
that was a nice moment.
He's cool.
Yeah.
He's a face like a very handsome cat.
Yeah. His eyes.
He's like a good-looking feline man face cat.
I'm sure it's a Batman villain.
Also an excellent actor.
Yes. And had a great year. I mean, in addition right. to you know, Moonlight.
He's in Hidden Figures.
He was in Free State of Jones. He was on Luke Cage. He's still in House of Cards. Like, he's doing all the things.
Do we want to just start talking about Hidden Figures since we're... catching up on some
real
titles.
Quick. I just wanted to point out the one of the things that I always love about the LAFCA dinner is that we invite all these people who are involved in that year's films, and you know, you forget that not all famous people know each other or have met before.
Which is weird because they all do live in the same small town of Celebrityville.
Yeah, you would think.
You'd think they'd all
they
know
all
each
go
other
to our Gelson's or whatever. But,
right.
But no, sometimes, you know, you get to see people meet each other, like meet their idols and get really excited about it. So like Colin Farrell came to accept the screenplay award for The Lobster because the two writers were in Greece.
So funny.
He gave a very funny speech. And then at the end of it, he was like, oh, wait, where's Isabelle Huppert? And totally like fanboyed out on her.
Yeah.
And like went and gave her a hug and stuff. It was rather adorable.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, Hidden Figures. You finally saw it.
Yes. It's very good.
It's very good. It's very entertaining.
I was a little reluctant.
Uh-huh.
Not because of the subject matter, because I love space math.
Sure.
I'm no good at it. I'm no good at it.
You're not good at Earth math.
I'm not good at Earth math. I need a calculator to add things at the grocery store as I'm shopping. Mm. Numbers are backwards and upside down for me.
Yes.
And so, but I was, you know, it's that end of the year, feel good, triumph.
Biopic
kind of movie. And they give me an itch.
Well, yeah. I mean, we recently had to deal with, you know, The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything in the same award season.
Yes.
It's like, enough with this already.
But it's really good.
Yeah. I mean, it is schmaltzy, but in a good way. Like, there's good,
I don't know that I would call it schmaltzy.
I think it's a little schmaltzy.
But
there's good schmaltz and there's bad schmaltz, and I think this is good schmaltz.
Okay. We're saying the same thing, but differently.
Okay.
It obeys a lot of the conventions of films of this sort.
Mm-hmm.
The pacing of this sort of thing, the story beats, the adversity, and the ultimate, you know, triumph.
Yes.
of in this story, these three women,
right?
Taraji P. Henson, Octavia mm-hmm. Spencer, Janelle Monáe,
right?
Each of them playing real life women, and is only Taraji P. Henson's character still alive?
I'm not even sure that she is.
Katherine Johnson? No, she's like 98.
Wow, okay.
Or something, and she's still alive.
Oh, amazing. I'm surprised they haven't, like...
Basically, she invented the new math.
Yeah, the involved in calculating trajectory and the Earth's atmosphere, I mean, you know, orbiting gravity and I don't really understand space math. But they all explain it very well. They make it in enough bite-sized chunks where you at least get the general idea of what
you
it is they're
doing.
You don't
get lost trying to understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
Even if you're dumb in the head like me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so stupid I had to be a film critic for a living.
Other doors were closed to you.
So, it's, but in spite of the fact that it obeys these conventions, it does so in a way that is not insulting to really anyone.
No.
Not to the characters and not to your own intelligence.
Right.
And best of all, not only are the performances good, particularly Taraji P. Henson.
Janelle Monáe is kind of blowing me away.
Janelle Monáe is great.
Moonlight, like,
yeah, no, she's very cool.
Yeah,
but this is what we talked about on
Press Play
on Madeline Brand. For the first time, I think in a big mainstream crowd pleasing film,
yeah,
atmospheric racism is treated as it should be for the most part.
So often, and I've talked about this on also on What the Flick, so if this sounds familiar, apologies. But yeah, so often in period films, the racists are all portrayed as these kind of
overtly bad people.
Foaming at the mouth, hideous, dog-kicking, awful, awful people.
Yes.
And what that does is allow 21st century audiences to go, oh, well.
White people.
Yeah, to go, sorry, 21st century white people to look at that and say, oh, well, I wouldn't be that guy. I'd be the nice progressive one.
You're operating in your 2015, 16, 17 mentality where racism, as it is expressed by folks like these old-timey characters, is abhorrent to you.
Which allows you to ignore the sort of coded, inherent, societally mandated, if not, it may, or at least accepted, racism.
Yeah.
And so you have these, you have the, you have white characters in this movie who are merely efficient and brusque and unthinkingly condescending and exclusionary. As a matter of course.
Because that's just how things work.
Yeah, they don't think about it. And the insidious thing about institutional racism is that you don't have to think about it. You don't have to get up in the morning and think about it. It's just there in
to
the
serve
world.
You.
Yeah, it's just yeah. It's making your life better and you don't even know it.
Right. You are a fish in a tank and you don't know that the water is all around you.
Yeah.
So the white characters in this film, none of them, with the exception of Jim Parsons, he's a meanie.
But he's condescending in so many fronts.
Right.
Because, I mean, just if you were a white woman, he would have been about as horrible.
Yeah, he would have.
You know, because like there's this whole thing where she is trying to calculate all this stuff for the John Glenn space flight, and they're constantly updating and changing the numbers at these meetings that she's not allowed to go to, and she keeps trying to go, and he's like, well, women aren't cleared for these meetings.
Right.
So it's like, oh, so this isn't even a black thing now. This is just that she's a woman.
It's all the things.
It's just sexism.
It's whatever's getting in the way of white guys running everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what the film does a good job of is presenting racism as a system that everyone in that moment, and in this moment,
let's not pretend it's over.
Racism is a system, and everyone participates in that system. And it benefits white people. It particularly benefits white men.
Yes.
It particularly benefits straight white men.
Yes.
And it does so in ways that you cannot see or hear or smell or think about, because you just, the thing that happened to you happened to you. The good thing that happened to you happened to you. Because a good thing was denied to someone else.
Right.
And the world has to keep changing in a forward direction in spite of the incompetent madman that we have just elected to the presidency. Well, the world has to keep changing in a forward direction so that this can either be destroyed, dismantled, minimized, moved out even farther to the margins, whatever it takes for there to be more justice in the world. But anyway, getting back to the film, after a little rant, the film does a good job of just giving you that sort of atmospheric system.
It also features the best version of Kevin Costner, which is Kevin Costner with a crew cut and glasses, wearing a short-sleeve white button-down shirt and a black tie.
Yeah.
60s Kevin Costner is the best Kevin Costner.
It is. I agree with you on that. Yeah.
And, you know, when Mahershala Ali and Taraji P. Henson have a really, like, they have crazy chemistry together.
They do.
And there's a scene where he is wooing her. You know, she's a widow with three young children. And I saw this movie with Bibbs, and he turned to me and said, okay, I'm gay now. Because Mahershala Ali is just like turning on the juice.
Congratulations, Bibbs.
We hope your wife is okay.
One of us. Sorry, Michelle. Well, you can come along. You can stay married to him.
Yeah, of course.
He's just gay now.
It would not be unprecedented.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, you know, I like it a lot, and I'm thrilled that it is finding an audience.
No, it like
it's
like the number one movie at the box office for 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, it bumped Rogue One out of the top spot. So you know, and again, what drives me nuts when a film that is geared toward women people of color, what, you know, gay audiences.
How did this happen? We never saw this coming.
Yeah. Studio. But worse than that, it's like, oh, well, that's a fluke.
Right.
Yeah. That's just this random crazy thing that happened this one time. You know, it's just an anomaly. Let's make 12 more white guy movies, please.
Somebody accidentally made a good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. So Moonlight, this, like, their success is just going to be considered this sort of crazy anomaly and not in any way an indication that, oh, by the way, there's an audience that is starving for some representation.
I'll tell you, I think their marketing campaign has a little bit to do with the...
Well, sure.
The success, because...
All marketing campaigns do.
I know, but this one is especially good. I don't even have to be in the living room if the commercial, the ad comes on for this movie. Because I am hearing Dance Party Pharrell music pumping out of the speakers.
I love that.
This is a movie about math. And it is being sold like a block party. And I really like that.
I do love, I can never remember, I don't remember what it's called, but the song that's in it that has the horn section as percussions.
Yeah.
Bum, 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 bum,
yeah,
bum,
yeah.
I love that song.
Well, yes, you do, and everyone does, because it's Pharrell.
Yeah.
And so that was very smart.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Math.
But you can dance
it's
to it.
It's a jam. Yeah.
Although, unfortunately, you know, somebody was, a friend of mine tweeted at Apple Music if there was a way to buy the soundtrack on iTunes without buying the song that is sung by the woman that Ellen kicked off the show.
Right, right. The gospel singer who behaved like a gospel singer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who even Pharrell, like, went on Ellen.
No, I know. Ugh. He was like, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Pharrell, you hired a gospel singer. To sing your song. She sure sings pretty.
Yep.
She doesn't like gays. Oops. Who could have imagined that a contemporary conservative evangelical gospel singer would have nasty things to say about gay people?
Shocked, I tell you. What? Shocked.
Who saw this coming? No one.
I'm going to barrel through two movies that I saw that you didn't because they are both utterly forgettable.
Barrel them.
One is Sleepless.
Then bury them.
Sleepless, which opened this weekend, the mistitled, with Jamie Foxx and Michelle Monaghan. It is apparently a remake of a French film that's supposed to be pretty good.
I didn't see the French one.
I did not either. It's a thriller called Nuit Blanche or Sleepless Nights. And Jamie Foxx is a policeman, but he's going undercover to ferret out corruption within the force. So he, you know, goes with his friend to, like, steal all this cocaine, but the cocaine belongs to this casino owner. And so the casino owner then kidnaps Jamie Foxx's son to get the cocaine back. Meanwhile, Michelle Monaghan is an internal affairs cop who thinks that Jamie Foxx is dirty because she doesn't know that he's undercover. So she takes the cocaine from him and... there's this, like, crazy drug guy, Lord, who's threatening everybody, who they're all afraid of, played by Scoop McNairy, and,
Are you done yet, talking about this?
All of this sounds...
When are you going to be done?
This sounds like it would be exciting. It's got a built-in sort of ticking clock, you know, suspense plot, and the movie is so... just kind of flaccid. This Swiss guy directed it. I forget his name. But it seriously, this movie has more skyline shots of the Vegas Strip than there are panning of the San Francisco skyline in The Room. I mean, so it just takes all the tension.
Las Vegas out. Is a very exciting place.
It's so cinematic, I know. But it deflates all the tension and all the sort of the suspense that should be happening. It's so just kind of blandly formulaic and generic and just like cop movie stuff. It's kind of like Triple Nine last year. Did you see that one?
Oh, yeah.
It's like Triple Nine without the crazy Kate Winslet as a Russian mob boss performance. Yeah, forget Sleepless. It ain't nothing. And then Underworld Blood Wars. Who cares?
I swore that we had already talked about this.
Yeah, I know. I had to prove to you that we hadn't. Yeah, it's a whole lot of nothing, and it's basically, you know, Kate Beckinsale is back, you know, would love for her to get an Oscar nomination for Love and Friendship. But in the meantime, she's back in pleather to be Selene, the Queen of the Undead or whatever.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's tons of, like, backstory and exposition as though anybody were watching these movies for the plot. And then when the vampires and the werewolves finally do fight each other, it's mostly with automatic weapons. And it's like, well, then who cares if they're vampires and werewolves? They could just be, like, mob factions at this point. And then as though these movies weren't already ridiculously ice blue, they actually go to an icy place. And there's one lady in the movie who, I think she's on like Game of Thrones or something, who's kind of like, for a moment you think, okay, she's going to just be campy enough to make us forget the rest of this movie, but even she just kind of gets ground down in all the plot stuff. And, you know, if you really want to see Theo James with his shirt off, they get there real fast, like second scene he's in.
Remind me who he is.
He's in the Elite Divergent movies.
Okay.
Big tall glass of nothing. It's nothing. This movie's just pointless.
You ain't bad. You ain't nothing.
Wesley Snipes.
Yeah. What else? What other film?
Well, we got some good stuff.
Patterson.
I loved Michael. No. Who did the intro last night from Lafka for Adam Driver, who wasn't there?
I don't know. I was in the bathroom.
Oh, it was very funny. And he talked about how, like, that's one of those movies where when you're a film critic and you're trying to convince your friends to go see it.
It's about this bus driver, see?
About a bus driver.
And he writes poetry. And then nothing really happens.
Yeah, exactly. And he goes, you could just see that flick in their eye. Oh, Jesus, film critics. But then, you know.
But it's about this bus driver scene.
But then when you.
And he writes poetry.
Yeah, and nothing much happens.
Nothing much happens.
But the bus driver is Adam Driver, and the writer-director is Jim Jarmusch, so maybe that'll win you.
I quite like this film.
It's terrific. Movies about writing is one of the hardest things to pull off because it's so uninteresting to look at. And this movie takes you through this internal process and really makes it something interesting. And it also turns the idea of Andrew Barker, that was who did the intro last night, it was very funny. It also takes the idea of the routine of life and of having a set schedule and having sort of a set pattern of how you do things and doesn't portray it as drudgery. It portrays it as almost this kind of zen
comfort.
Yeah.
Comfort and contentment. And that is, I believe, the point of the film. Also, structurally, it's quite beautiful. Because not only are its rhythms and its visual components very much like a poem itself.
Yes.
It does. There's a scene in the middle of the film where he's waiting to go in to work, and he meets this little girl.
Oh, it's so great.
And it turns out, just coincidentally, she has a notebook that she's writing poems in. And she reads him the poem. It's a nice little poem. And he sort of advises her on what's good about it and what's not. And the dialogue tips the film's hand by explaining the film to you. He says, you know, some of it rhymes and some of it doesn't, but there's nice, you know, mirroring imagery and there's
internal
nice internal rhymes happening. And he says, it's lovely to meet a real poet. But he's a real poet.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's just not published. He's doing this for his own enjoyment.
And the movie does have a lot of weird internal stuff. Like, for example, I mean, part of me thinks Adam Driver got cast as a bus driver to fit in with the general scheme of the film. Because he plays a guy whose last name is Patterson, who lives in Patterson, New Jersey.
Yes.
There are twins. There are lines of dialogue that are repeated by different characters in different contexts. There are sort of, you know, like I said, every, you know, the movie sort of structured around the course of a week, and every morning begins with him waking up just before the alarm clock goes off and looking at his watch.
Yes.
And you know, just there's so many sort of like little repetitions and little weird coincidences, and they never beat you over the head with them. It's not like Dirk Gently where they're constantly talking about how everything's connected, you know. It's just sort of this odd how life has these patterns and has these rhythms that you fall into, whether or not you notice them and whether or not they're intentional in any way.
If I have any problem with the film, it is this one thing.
I think I know what you're going to say.
You know exactly what I'm going to say. I am not fully comfortable with the character of his wife/girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Do we know if they're married? Are we ever told if they're... It doesn't matter, I guess.
I can't remember if they say for sure. They live together.
They do live together. Golshifte Farhani.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to pronounce her first name. Golshifte. It is a name I have not encountered before. Okay. She leaves the house twice in this film. She is as devoted to him as he is devoted to her. But it does feel like a little bit of a weird power imbalance. I think if you met these people and they were real life people, they would say to you that no, there is no power imbalance. We both give because we love each other. But as it is depicted, it feels a little bit like she's this sweet housewife who doesn't do much and who is thrilled to be taken out to the movies every so often and get a little present every so often.
I don't think that's fair. I think that she has her own sort of artistic ambitions that she pursues.
She does.
She creates things at home. She makes these amazing matching cupcakes.
She does.
She gets a guitar at one point.
Yes.
I think that she's pursuing her own stuff. And I mean, the movie is told from his point of view, so we don't know whether or not she leaves the house during the day while he's
The film
gone.
Shows us that she leaves the house two times.
That we see.
Right. That's the film's job, is to show us something.
The film...
It's the film's job for us to see things.
But the film is not responsible for showing us all the details of every single character.
I know.
You know, we don't know. Does the bartender never leave the bar? Because he's always there when we see him in the movie, you know.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because everyone that Adam Driver needs is right in that person's place every time he needs them. And because of that, the film takes on the quality, I feel, of a kind of fantasy, a kind of utopian fantasy that a heterosexual man might invent for himself. You know, this domestic bliss where everything is in its place and everybody around him exists to be there when he needs them and tell him kind of how good he is.
But you do that for me.
What do you mean?
You make this house great. And
take a look at it right now. Tell me if that's the truth.
Okay, look, it may not be pristine, but it's great. And you know, if I'm off for the day doing things and stuff, I don't know if you're here or not, or
right.
What your deal is. And, right. And you know, if somebody were making a movie that was following me around, it might look like
I would be in the kitchen a lot.
Yeah,
that's true. No, that is true. That is true.
But you're a three-dimensional, fully fulfilled human being. And I think so is the wife/girlfriend.
Maybe. It just felt like a little bit like a rock in my shoe.
I hear where you're coming from. I have been in discussion groups where all the men liked the movie and all the women had questions about it. And I don't know. I don't think it's unfair to that character, and I don't think that it diminishes her in any way. But you know,
no, that's the thing. The film never overtly diminishes her or demeans her.
Mm-hmm.
The film loves her.
Yeah.
But
okay,
it's his little perfect world.
Sure.
And I feel a little weird about it.
All right. Well, people should still see this movie.
No, it is. I'm not saying it's not a good movie, and I'm not saying you should not see it. Mm. I'm saying it's a beautifully made film.
Yes.
And I do really like it quite a bit. I just have this little nagging, itching thing about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a fair cop. I don't agree with you, but I see where you're coming from.
Well, you're wrong.
Get back in the kitchen.
As soon as we're done podcasting, I am getting back in the kitchen. I got a cake to finish baking.
I know.
Yeah. Julieta.
Yes.
The new Pedro Almodovar.
I saw this.
Film. Why don't you tell people what it is about?
So, Julieta begins in the 90s. A woman is on a train and she meets one man, has kind of a flirtation with him, and another man who seems kind of desperate tries to talk to her, and she kind of blows him off to go spend time with the other man, and the desperate man commits suicide, and she feels guilty and responsible, even though really she didn't have anything to do with it.
Nothing.
The man that she meets on the train, it turns out, has a wife who's been very sick for a very long time. And when she goes to see him, the wife has just died. The man's housekeeper is played by Rossi De Palma in a very Hitchcockian sense. She is...
Well, the Hitchcockian stuff is more than Rossi De Palma. It's the train and
there's a lot of
music
stuff.
But the blonde lady.
Oh, yeah, no. There's,
Julieta
there's,
there, is a Hitchcock blonde.
There's a lot of Hitchcock and there's a lot of Cirque in this movie, but it is all Almodovar.
Yes.
Anyway, she falls in love with the man, even though it turns out he has been having an affair with this sculptress during all the years that his wife was sick. And nonetheless, the Julieta and the sculptress become friends. Julieta and the fisherman have a daughter. And then while the daughter is away, Julieta and the husband have an argument over something. And there's a storm. He goes out when he shouldn't have and dies. And then
this does not constitute spoilers.
Yeah, this is all early on in the story.
Yeah.
Julieta is devastated by this, and when the daughter finds out, that puts a gap between them. And then we jump ahead years later and most of this is told in flashback. We really begin with the older Julieta, who is about to leave Spain and move on with her life with a new man.
Yes.
And then out of the blue, she runs into a friend of her daughter's. And it brings back all these memories and all this guilt and all this desire now that she has to stay in Madrid in the hopes that the daughter might come back or write her a letter or something because they've been estranged for so long.
It's not just that she's estranged from the daughter. The daughter is essentially missing.
Well, the daughter has blocked her out of her life.
And no one, and she doesn't know where she is.
Yeah.
Or whatever became of her.
Right.
Only that she disappears one day.
Until she sees the friend, and the friend is, I ran into her. It's like, wait, what? You know,
right.
And that sets all this stuff in motion. It is another amazing Almodovar movie about the lives of women and about mothers and daughters and about love and sacrifice and guilt and, God, I love this movie so much.
I agree with you. I think that it may be seen as perhaps a minor film from him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe it is.
No, there's so much going on in here.
That it is simply less invested in what we have now come to know as Almodovar's trademark wildness.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a bit of a shout out to that. In one scene, the one scene that really made me laugh, they walk into a new apartment that they're thinking of renting. And she says, wallpaper's a bit oppressive, don't you think? And the daughter says, no, I think it's cool. Now, if you've seen any Almodovar films, no matter whether they are comedies or dramas.
The wallpaper.
If the man wanted to have a secondary career, he would lend his name to a line of wild wallpapers because that is the ongoing thread.
The aesthetic through line.
The domestic life of every person in every Pedro Almodovar film involves crazy wallpaper.
I want Almodovar wallpaper, and I want the Darjeeling Limited towel and luggage sets.
Yes. So the idea that someone walks into a room like that and says, "This is a bit oppressive," is kind of a cue for you to know, you know, you're still in the hands of this one director, but he's not exactly giving you the things you've been getting from him before.
Yeah.
This reminds me in tone of films like Volver, of Broken Embraces.
Yeah.
In that you're never fully certain what's going to happen.
Flower of My Secret.
Who's going to do it? Yeah. Or if you're ever going to understand why.
Yeah.
What's happening is happening.
You're going to get all the answers or all the motivations behind these really complicated interpersonal relationships.
He refuses in this film to give you information that you're dying for by the end of the movie.
I will say this. And, I always,
and when it was over, I thought, wait, but why? Why did the thing happen?
Yeah. I watch his stuff. He's one of the few directors that I always make it a point to watch twice before I review it.
Yeah.
And there were things I picked up on the second go-round that were not immediately apparent to me on the first go-round.
I see.
So I think the more you see it, the more little cues and hints will surface that kind of... And even then, they may not completely answer all your questions, but at least they touch upon them more, I think.
And we always talk about Todd Haynes as the master of the semiotic.
Yeah.
Because that's the cliche of the Todd Haynes.
Right, because he studied semiotics at Brown.
And people, it's an ongoing topic of conversation about Todd Haynes films.
Yeah.
I don't think we talk about Almodovar in that context as much as we should.
Mm.
Because he is all about the coded gesture and the object in place of a feeling, or
the color
the color of something repeating. And I love that so much about him. And I love his understanding of the weirdness of human experience.
Mm.
And why the way things happen in movies isn't necessarily the way things happen in life. And he will give that to you. He will give you the weird reality. But it's so highly stylized,
right,
that you miss it sometimes.
And the thing is, and he does stylization in a way that it never completely takes you out of the story. You never step back and go, "Oh, look at that thing." And if you do, it's momentarily and then you're back in. Because ultimately, these movies are so well written and so humane that as however many shout-outs there might be to Hitchcock or Cirque, or like the way that the music will be kind of swirlingly old-fashioned, it's never a thing where you laugh or you are taken out of it. It's not like... You know, and I've made this comparison before. It's not like where you know, you watch a Tarantino movie and he does a deliberate anachronism, or he does a shout out to an old movie in a way. You know, like he'll play that David Bowie song in Inglourious Basterds, which is not only an anachronism, but it's also from another movie.
Right.
You know, and you're supposed to like stop and notice all that stuff. And Almodovar will, you know, and the way that Todd Haynes does, that same movie love is in there, but it's always in service to the story. It's always in service to the world that's being created. And it doesn't, you're never asked to sort of remove yourself from it and go, "Oh, nice." Like it becomes part of the context. It becomes part of the world these people exist inside.
Yeah.
So yeah. God, go see Julieta. Made my top
and
10
it's beautiful looking, as all of Almodovar's,
of course.
All
yeah.
Almodovar's films are. Yeah. I would like to push the discussion of I, Daniel Blake to the next show.
Okay.
So that we have time to do letters and stuff like that.
Okay.
Also to talk about a film that I finally just caught up with.
Oh, seeing. Right, yes.
This movie opened in October, the second week of October.
It premiered at Sundance last year.
So all the film critic people I knew saw it a year ago already. but it opened to the public in October. I just looked up the stats on this film, Christine.
Yes.
Ain't nobody went to see this movie. It played on 57 screens nationwide.
Uh-huh.
So if you lived in a big city that had an art house, it probably showed up in your town for about a week.
Right.
And it made $298,000. I am not surprised by this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's...
Here's what it's about. Christine Chubbuck was a news reporter on Sarasota TV News in Florida in the early 70s. And she is now, what, 40 years later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Notorious for killing herself on live television.
Yes.
Yeah. She put a gun to her head. And the footage has never been seen since, at the request of the family.
Right.
They had it locked away. But suddenly, in 2016, there are two movies about her.
Right.
There's this one, and there's a documentary called Kate Plays Christine.
Right.
About an actress preparing to play Christine Chubbuck.
Which also screened at Sundance last year.
Which also was at Sundance, yes. Now, I have not seen Kate Plays Christine.
Nor have I. I did see it on a worst of the year list. Somebody,
did you?
Yeah. Somebody, interesting. Somebody was really not down for that one, but I have not seen it.
So. Fascinating. Anyway, Christine, the one we're talking about, stars Rebecca Hall.
Right.
As Christine Chubbuck. I love Rebecca Hall.
Oh, she's amazing.
Everything she does, I'm just riveted by her.
Ever since Vicky Cristina Barcelona, yeah. I've been on board, yeah.
And I know the family of Christine Chubbuck wants nothing to do with either of these films.
Right.
But really sort of talked, you know, negatively about this particular film, calling it exploitation.
Hmm.
I don't think of it as exploitation.
No.
At
no,
all. No. I think it's really pretty well made, and there are some externals in the film that occasionally might lead you to, you know, think, oh, well, that's why. That's why she was depressed. That's why she killed herself.
Right.
But in general, the film really does pull back from wanting to assign
explanations,
reasons or explanations. This was 1974.
Yeah.
And I don't know how well the psychiatric world understood bipolar disorder
mm-hmm.
In 1974. The family now thinks of her as having had that.
Yeah.
Although, you know, we don't know. We know that she was being treated for depression from childhood.
Right.
And that's something the film doesn't really talk about very much. They don't talk about her lifelong, you know, situation with depression. And they leave out some family information that I only after watching the film went and looked up.
Uh-huh.
Stuff like she was very close to her grandparents, and they lived nearby in Sarasota. And she chose the day to kill herself on TV when she knew they would not be watching.
Mm.
That's not in the movie.
Mm.
But what is in the film is this really, really... There are different kinds of acting. Okay, there's the Adam Driver Patterson style of acting where very little is happening
mm-hmm.
on your face. It's outward. Very mm-hmm. it's very subtle.
Yeah.
All the way down to people like in Bresson films that are meant to not be doing anything.
Right. Know? Who are generally non-professionals.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's more, did I say there's two types of acting? There's a whole, there's more than two types. Okay. There's more than two types.
Dave White acting school.
Yeah. There's more than two types. But there is this kind of acting that involves, you know, a lot of demonstration.
Yes.
A lot of grand gestures.
Right. Indication theater,
and there's
our friend Sean would call
there's
it.
A bit of that in Rebecca Hall's performance, but again, not too much.
No, I think it's an exquisite performance.
And I find her performance in this film very, very moving.
Yeah.
And I think the filmmaking is also very, very compassionate.
That was the word I was going to say. What I think keeps the movie from being exploitative is its compassion. And frankly, I'm sorry the family, has to have these old wounds picked at, but
right.
She belongs to history now. You know,
she chose to be a part of history.
Yeah, and yeah. Her story, I think, has resonance beyond the sort of gory aspects of
right.
it. You know, I think it says a lot about, as you were saying, you know, how much were we ready to deal with, you know, certain kinds of mental illness, about feminism in the early 70s, about
yes.
women in the workplace trying to get equal footing. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Antonio Campos, who directed this. Maybe not a big fan, because I didn't like his second movie a lot. But I
You're a medium fan.
I'm a medium fan. Okay. I loved his first film, After School, and this one. And both films sort of deal with the horrors of life as filtered through the camera.
Yeah.
You know, After School is about kids who are obsessed with watching. They probably, if they could find the Christine Chubbuck footage on the internet, they would.
Well, yeah, like in the '80s. I remember in the '80s, it was very punk rock to have a VHS of Bud Dwyer.
I don't know what that is.
The guy who shot himself in the head. He was a politician.
Oh, okay.
Faces of Death and stuff
right,
like
right,
that.
Right,
you
yeah.
know.
There's that character and that guy in Slacker who has the footage of the guy who holds his like thesis committee hostage or whatever. Remember?
Oh yeah.
Anyway, but it was like the characters in After School would totally. That's the sort of thing they would look at. They were totally obsessed with like just online kind of sex and violence stuff, and then their sort of inability to deal with it when it's actually happening in front of them.
Yeah.
And then this film, you know, again, is so much about television and about. How TV news works and what the sort of image versus reality. I think these are really kind of interesting multi-layered examinations, not just of the characters and of the stories they're telling, but of how the media shapes the world and the way that we perceive things.
You and I were supposed to record this podcast 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately after I watched this film.
Right.
And I was so overwhelmed by this movie that I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Rebecca Hall's performance is so moving to me that a thing that never happens to me happened to me. This movie made me cry.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the middle of the film where she goes out on a date with Michael C. Hall, who plays her kind of lunk-headed anchor colleague.
Yeah, he's sort of like the brash sports guy.
Yeah. And she is in the bathroom practicing her smile for the mirror. Because everything you see over and over again in the film, how she makes to-do lists and rehearses herself and wants to present this other person to the world. It is no coincidence that there are Carpenters posters on her wall in her house. Because in a lot of ways, this film did remind me of Superstar.
Mm.
In its look and in its, empathy for this woman. She's practicing her smile. There's an old Guess Who song from the 70s playing. It's called Laughing. And it's just a song I remember from childhood. But it's a song about having everything taken from you. And as she's walking back to the date, the mirror, the seams in the mirror reflect different parts of her. And the cumulative effect of her moving back out into the world, ready to present this good face, that she's not convinced herself that she's really pulling off. Just brought me to tears, and I can see why, as much as I like this movie, I can see why people would not want to watch it.
Because it puts you through the ringer.
It's painful. Yeah. And it's... Yeah. I recommend it. And at the same time...
With a caveat.
Maybe not if you're going to be really upset by it. In terms of her killing herself thing, they do show you it happening.
Yes.
And I kind of wish they hadn't.
I think it would have felt like too much of a tease to not address it.
Maybe. It's not super disgusting.
No, and it's an impactful moment the way they do it.
I have spoken to at least two people, friends. I will not say their names, but two people I know who deal with depression, and one of whom deals with bipolar disorder. And one of them said, I will not be watching this film. And another had already seen it and said to me exactly what I wound up thinking about it myself, that it felt very much like empathy. And this person really loves this film.
Yeah. No, Hall is great. Both Halls are great. Rebecca Hall is amazing. I really enjoyed Michael C. Hall's supporting performance, and also Tracy Letts as the station manager. Oh, yeah,
the mean station manager. The
awful, awful station manager.
It's available for sale now on iTunes. Like you have to buy it.
Yeah, and it comes on DVD on February 14th.
On Valentine's. What is that, irony? Like, what is the...
I think Valentine's Day just happens to be a Tuesday this year, and a lot of DVDs will come out that day. They won't all be lovey.
Yeah. It's very sad.
Yeah.
And I'm still thinking about it. It still makes me...
Yeah. It's a lot.
I guess this is my DVD pick. I don't know. You can watch it now if you want to buy it. Mm-hmm. If not, you have like a month or 3 weeks. 3 weeks, I guess, ish to wait. Yeah.
My DVD pick this week, I didn't really think about it. I'm going to say...
I didn't either. This occupies that weird no man's land of...
Right.
It's not fully in theaters anymore. It's not fully available yet.
I'm going to say that the entire Almodovar feature collection, with the exception of Julieta, is now streaming on iTunes. Quite a few of them are in new digital restorations. If you are not up on your Almodovar, go catch up. He is, for my money, our greatest living filmmaker. So go see his movies.
Here's a letter from Samantha. Subject line is, La La Land killed all the little children. Hey, David Alonso, I write to you to tell you about my experience seeing La La Land, mostly because I want to hear you comment on this film again, and I thought you might get a kick out of my weird story. I'm not ready to comment on this film again yet, because I still have not yet gone back to see it in a theater,
right?
Which is your command of me.
Nor have I.
But I will, because it's still playing, and Tony Erdman. Yeah. My friend Kaz and I have been waiting to see this movie since the Toronto Film Festival that her brother had been to, where he had raved about the glories of a comedy musical with freaking Emma Stone in it, and the trailers only convinced us more. Kaz and I are 17, so we had to drive over directly after school to make the 4:10 showing. After buying insubordinate amounts of popcorn, we took our seats in the theater to find that A, there were maybe only 20 people other than us in the whole theater, and B, they were all over 65. We chuckled about this, figured it was because it was so early, and then started to watch the movie.
You're suddenly like talking much louder and much closer to your mic.
Oh, am I?
Yeah.
Relax, all right, I'll move back.
Relax, Louise.
All right. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. 2 hours later, if the security cameras had panned down on the audience, you could see roughly 20 old people placidly watching the conclusion of this freaking movie until you hit about the 10th row, where there are two teenage girls hysterically weeping, whisper screaming, "No, no, oh God, no!" By the time the lights came on, we were reduced to literally collapsing on top of each other with our tears, and we had to stay in the theater for another 10 minutes to calm ourselves down before we could leave the screening. If it so inclines you, there is a crappy quality video to emphasize our sorrow. I don't know.
It's attached.
I didn't. I don't have that video attached.
Oh.
What, did they make a video of themselves crying?
Yes, I didn't watch that part.
Well, when the show... We'll look at it later, yeah. Because young people crying is the best.
That's why we watch Chasing Cameron on Netflix.
Exactly. We inched our way out of the theater, gripping the guardrail to find a sea of old people standing outside the theater waiting for us to come out. They persistently asked if we were all right and if we needed anything, to which my friend replied, "I need my life put back together." Kaz then drove me home and proceeded to burst into tears whenever, without love or defying gravity, he came on her Spotify. I spent a very long night trying to figure out why I was so emotionally slaughtered by this movie, and it eventually comes down to the fact that I'm a senior in high school, and the ending of this movie really showcases our worst possible fears. For someone who is trying to gauge what to do with the rest of their life, the prospect of the montage at the end...
We won't go into details.
All right. Shows exactly what we don't want to happen. Is that so? I'll continue reading, and then we'll go back to that question.
We'll dig into this.
So far, we have not told you any spoilers.
Right.
And neither has the letter. So, just that there's a thing at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. We want the best of both worlds and not the best of one. Which brings me back to the senior citizens at the theater. The film really works for everyone because older people can look back at more traditional film experience while young people can have existential crises and everyone in between can feel everything in between. It's definitely one of my favorite films, and so I have to ask what movies you think young people like me should see.
Whoa.
All of them. I'll stop wasting your time with this very long email rant about this movie. Have a lovely day. Sincerely, Sam. Okay, well, what movies should you see? You should see The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And Young Girls of Rochefort.
Totally.
And, that's a good place to start.
Singing in the Rain, for that matter.
Singing in the Rain. It. Yeah.
It's Always Fair Weather.
Obviously, they like musicals. They wouldn't have Defying Gravity on their Spotify.
Right. I think what I glean from this experience, Sam, and not to sound like condescending old guy, but I think that you are young and have probably not had your heart broken in a significant way yet.
Not enough, anyway.
Yeah. And what happens as you get older is that there are disappointments and there are heartbreaks and there are paths not taken. And no matter how great the place that you wind up is, there's always going to be a part of you that wonders about the what if, about paths that were closed off to you or that you opted not to travel down. And La La Land, I think, very beautifully captures that. And for older audiences, it's a kind of reminder of that thing in our lives that we all sort of live with and acknowledge and try not to stew on, but, you know, right. We know that it's there. And I think for young people, it's maybe a somewhat horrifying possibility that, oh my God, that's how life works. But
what if this one good thing I like is going to happen, but what if this other good thing could be better than the one thing that I'm going to do?
Or what if I blow it or the other person blows it or circumstances blow it?
It's
you know?
the fear of risking something and maybe it not working out the way you wanted it to.
Yeah.
And so then having this other reality, this alternate story that does come along and takes you in a whole other direction. If you could see it before it happens, you wouldn't want it. But after it happens to you, you think, oh, no, that turned out to be the way I needed it to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
So
I don't look back on anything.
I mean...
And think, oh, what if? I'm like, it's done.
I, for the most part, don't either. There are a few little...
I made your life a paradise of love.
You did indeed. So that's why I don't really dwell on it much. But there are some forks that I wonder about how things would have gone
badly,
and they aren't necessarily all.
I fixed it all.
They aren't necessarily all romantic, Dave White. Some of them are professional. Some of them
I fixed that too.
You know, so
with this podcast,
so that's just
that you invented.
That's just how life goes, Sam. And I'm glad that you found this movie evocative enough to really kind of react to it so strongly emotionally. And I think as you get older, you will continue to cherish this movie, but you will also be able to contextualize it within your own life and your own choices.
You might hate it later in life, too.
That, too? You never know.
No.
But, you know, all we can do is our best in the moment. And, you know, we just sort of figure out later how that all
That you ruined
out.
It.
Nonetheless, I thank you for...
I tried my best. I ruined it.
Thank you for telling us your story and for writing into the show. We appreciate it. You'll be fine, I promise.
We don't have time for any more letters, so.
We don't?
Nope.
Oh, we got cake. Sorry.
Cake.
Okay. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Go check him out at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com and the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, the B-Movies podcast, and Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Sewers of Paris, The Joe Ryan Thing, Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. And as I mentioned on LKTV this week, go check out Pod Save America.
Yeah.
Not that you need me to tell you. It's like the number one podcast right now. But it's from, it's Jon Favreau, not the director, but the Obama speechwriter, and several other kind of Obama insiders, basically talking about, like, now what, and how do we fix this, and how do we carry on, and how do we fight back. And it's an interesting show. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at LinoleumCast. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, and if you want to leave us a good review there, that does help. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or Podbean or CastBox or Satchel. If you're on Android, we're on Google Music. And hey, join our club, Linoleum Podcast. Sorry, it's patreon.com/...
What even is the name of it?
Sorry. Patreon.com/LinoleumKnife. Get our other podcast, LKTV, our podcast of the television, and other great stuff. We had several new people join this week.
Shockingly.
Which is great. Thank you, Shelby, and I don't have all the other names in front of me, but
other people.
All of you guys who are new subscribers, we really appreciate it. It's a nice way to kick off 2017.
Yep.
And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We're almost caught up with letters. It's very exciting.
It is.
And also very exciting is that we will have a second episode
this
weekend.
We're recording another episode in about 90 minutes.
Yes, with our dear friend Manolo Dargis, who couldn't make it last week for our 2016 in review episode with Peter DeBruges and Robert Abele. But we're going to go over stuff with her and see what she liked and
whatever,
didn't like
whatever
and
things
whatever she wants to talk about.
We're letting her run the show.
Basically.
More or less.
Which is as one should. So anyway, thank you guys for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.